This is the Cyber Union Talk Show for Tuesday, September 20th, 2011.
The long and unconditional history of industrial action. Hello and welcome to Cyber Unions. I'm Walton in Glasgow, Scotland.
And I'm Stephen in Boston, Massachusetts. How are we doing today, Walton?
We're doing quite well. It's been quite interesting on the Cyber Unions website. I've been looking at the stats over the past week, and we're at record numbers. People are visiting us. And I think we mentioned Reddit a couple of shows ago, and we've actually had quite a lot of visitors from Reddit. So if there are any Redditors listening, welcome. And also thanks to everyone who visited our website and shared some of the material. And I see we've had quite a few links coming in from Freakbook and Twitter and all the social networks. And it's just good to see that we might be running out of bandwidth for the third month in a row.
Yeah, that's definitely a good sign. A lot of activity going on the site. There was amazing. The numbers just kind of surprised me because, I don't obsess about it. About the numbers all the time about
the
site.
You do.
Well, yeah, I guess that's kind of true. But one day I just kind of woke up and was just like looking at numbers and was like, why are we already at this like high in the morning in my time? And usually it's not even there till like midday my time. And I was just really surprised when it kept going. And I was like, wow, pretty impressive. But there was some information that you saw in the analytics, I think it was. What'd you see there?
Yeah, what I found quite interesting about the analytics is that obviously we can tell where people are visiting, what countries. Mostly it's U.S., Canada, and U.K., though there is actually quite a widespread and people coming from all over the world. But you can also tell what operating system and browser people are using. So there's a strange split, and the split is that about one third of people are using Linux and they're using something like Chromium or Firefox. And another third are using Microsoft and Internet Explorer. And that suggests two quite separate audiences. I suspect that people using Linux are obviously very tech savvy people who are interested in free and open source software, possibly don't know all that much about unions. I'm not sure. That's just a guess. And the people who are using Internet Explorer are probably don't know the tech that well, but I'm imagining they must be trade unionists or people who are involved in politics in some other way, because I can't tell why else they would visit the site. But it is interesting that we seem to have these two distinct audiences, and hopefully we can bring them together and build some kind of community of practice around technology and organizing.
Yeah, which obviously is, I think, the goal of what we're trying to do. And actually, it's interesting because connecting is something that in one of the things that happened in the last week for me, I was playing with this other version of Minecraft. Minecraft is, I think I've talked about it briefly, just a kind of fun little game where you can go and build things, and there's like survival mode and all this other stuff. But it's a proprietary software. It's run on Java, but the software itself is not released in free and open source. There's this other one called MineTest that is a GPL free and open source version. It's not the same thing. It's trying to be a little bit different. When I was playing with it, I ended up connecting a couple of people together, interestingly enough, that are working on it. It's kind of an interesting experience. Just seeing like a person from Australia had not known about it, and I apparently got him addicted enough that he dented that I was responsible for him losing 3 hours of work. Then there are some people here that aren't exactly programmers, but figured out a way to play with the source code on the MineTest to change things. And it's kind of interesting just to see the connections coming together just by chance. It was through IRC of all things too, which is kind of funny. But have you ever played? No, you probably shouldn't actually. It'll be too addicting.
I've never been into the world of Minecraft.
Yeah, well, that's good though, to be honest. But another thing I ended up doing this past week was trying to install GNU Linux onto a friend's computer, and I ran into a bit of a glitch. One computer had a working hard drive with Windows on it, which was hard to see. I had not booted up Windows in ages, and just seeing XP just like threw chills down my spine.
I know the feeling. I get it every morning at work.
Well, The HP Pavilion was so old that the BIOS wouldn't let you boot from USB, so I couldn't install GNU Linux through USB, so I tried doing it through CD, and the CD drive got power, but the device didn't know it was there, so I couldn't boot in to install. The other laptop had a working CD player, but not a working hard drive. And I had fail written all over my head. I've never had a system that I could not install anything on, and it just pissed me off.
Well, I don't think hardware failures are your fault. I don't think you can be forgiven for that one.
That's true. It's true. It's just, you know, it's the hope. I'm going to go back on that Pavilion and bring my external hard drive with me and try to get it installed so I can get him up on GNU Linux. He wants to, which is a good thing. So we'll see what happens. Good.
Well, your commitment is inspiring.
Oh, yeah. Well, trying my best and trying my hardest in the time I can. But actually, I think I told you about the show that I end up seeing, which is David Rovics, which you told me about.
He was in Glasgow. I think a few weeks ago at the student occupation at the Free Hetherington. I spoke to some of the students, and they said that he'd played a show for them, and they really enjoyed it. They were really impressed with this.
Yeah. Well, is interesting, because when I went to see him, I thought about that and your comment, and he kind of had a little beginning of the show. He was doing a recording for the organization that he was at, and then at the end they asked some questions, and when it got quiet, I just stuck my hand up and decided to ask, like, so you were at the sit-ins in Scotland, because my friend told me about it. I just wanted him to share that experience. And he just got this huge smile on his face and was really talking about how much he enjoyed the experience there and the battles that were going on. That when he got there, the students were occupying an administrative building. And at one point they went out into the balcony, and David started the song of Burn It Down, Burn It Down. And the cops were outside and everything else, and it seemed that the administration got pretty annoyed and concerned, because they actually thought the students were going to burn the place down, apparently. They started questioning whether they wanted to put them back into the other building, which was the Hetherington, I think it is. Is that correct?
Hetherington, yeah.
And it was just really cool to see that, you know, this connection of, you know, Scotland to Boston here, just in a matter of days, I guess you could say, from when things happened, right?
Yeah, that's fantastic. It was a great occupation. It lasted 6 months and they won, and that's always good news. So yeah, that's just really good. I think we should try and get him on the show sometime.
Yeah, yeah, I did at the end of the show. I actually went up and introduced myself and asked him if he'd be willing to, and he did say he'd like to be on the show. So I'm going to try to figure out when we can interview him and try to get him on together so we can have a conversation about what his work is and how he connects music to activism, and also the way he actually uses technology, which is pretty cool stuff. So definitely going to happen in the near future. We'll see where it goes. So okay. In the meantime, what have you been up to, Walton?
Well, I remember a few shows back when we were talking about Cory Doctorow's For the Win, which is a book that we both love. You told me about Little Brother, another book of his, which I haven't read. So I finally got around to reading it, and I downloaded it off his website. And as listeners might remember, Cory Doctorow releases all these books on a Creative Commons license, so you can actually download them for free from his website and read them. And I read it on my phone. And
nice.
Yeah. That is the first time I've ever read an entire book on any kind of electronic device. I'm a later doctor. I have so far been the sort of person who fetishizes the artifacts of physical books with pages and all that kind of thing. So it was
a new notes.
Yeah. So it was a new experience reading it on the phone, but it was a great book. I really enjoyed it. I got through it really, really quickly. And its subject, as you know, is all about security.
Yeah.
And it got me paranoid enough to stop sort of halfway through the first chapter and change the security settings on my phone.
Nice.
It's a story that's aimed at teenagers, and I actually think that all teenagers should read it, because it's really, really good about resisting illegitimate authority and finding ways to protect yourself and protect your privacy and all that kind of thing. But the information in there is really useful and really accurate for anyone, not just for teenagers. It's basically about how a group of kids manages to resist, set in, what is it, San Francisco?
Yeah, and, yeah, that's great.
They're trying to resist an increasingly intrusive state surveillance system. So the first thing they talk about is Tor. Now, we spoke about Tor on a show once before, and you had installed it and played with it, and you said it was easy. I hadn't. Well, after that show, I actually went and tried it, and I installed it, and it works fine. Tor was, you know, not any kind of tech genius or anything, but it was easy enough to install. And I went browsing on Tor, and it was really, really cool because, you know, as listeners will remember, what Tor does is it reroutes your internet traffic so that it's difficult to know where you're logging in from. So it was really interesting because I would visit a website and I'd see targeted ads, and the ads would be for Utrecht in the Netherlands. And then 10 minutes later, the ads would be from somewhere in Indonesia or Austin, Texas, or, you know, just random places all around the world. And it was kind of cool to know that that technology was working and protecting me from intrusion. I can see how that would be really useful for people in countries with repressive regimes. But the other thing that I thought was really cool in that book is that they run this distro of Linux called Paranoid Linux. And it's like Tin Hat Linux for like super paranoid people who know the government is out to get them. And it's you know, super secure. And I just thought how awesome it would be if there was actually something like that, if Paranoid Linux existed.
Well, it actually does. I'm surprised I forgot to actually bring this up when we did our Tor show, but there's something called Tails, which is it stands for the Amnesic Incognito, I think, Linux. Oh shoot, I always miss up the names on it. It's either way, we'll put the link in the show notes for it. But it's basically a USB version. It's supposed to run on a USB version of Linux, so you can plug it into any computer, boot up, and be running a full version of Linux with the security that Tor brings. And it's intended, I think, to be USB specifically because, you know, they don't want you to have all your stuff on your computer because then you'd easily be tracked. Whereas USB, they, you know, you keep going and plugging into different places, they're not going to be able to easily track you.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a pretty cool thing.
So you could feasibly use that at an internet cafe or something like that. And
you do need a little bit of a bigger USB device. I mean, it'll work like on a 2 meg or 2 gigabyte one, but if you're going to use this an everyday or make sure you're saving data to it as well, you're going to need a little bit bigger space because I even ran into a problem when I was trying to update from OpenOffice, which I think came on it, to LibreOffice, and I ran out of space immediately. And it was a little bit more troublesome to try to work around when you're dealing with a smaller one, but it definitely works. So if like our listeners are in places where they want to be able to carry it along with them so they can plug into any computer, boot it up, and run it from USB, that's Tails, which it's a great little device that came about, I think, I want to say in the last year or two that it started formation, but I don't want to be claimed to be accurate on that one, but it is the Tor version.
So I just Googled it, and it does stand for the Amnesic Incognito Live System. But how does it work? Like, you know, what does it actually do that's different?
Well, so it by default, with all the connections, I believe, would be connected to the different nodes of the Tor network.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, like, the Tor itself, like, there's, like, a one USB version just for the browser that you can just go and open up the browser from a USB device, which will connect to the Tor network just for the browsing purposes. This, in this case, is not just for browsing itself, but for the whole system as a whole to be connected to the Tor network. Keeping that anonymity there.
Why is it called amnesic?
I think it's because it's a system that's supposed to have amnesia.
Okay.
So it's supposed to forget everything.
Okay, cool.
which could be troublesome for people who have bad memories. Like myself, I'd be like, wait a second, I can't remember what I did here. And then if you forget website addresses, it could be a little bit troublesome in that case.
not quite as convenient as Google Chrome with all its kind of
auto-remembering
everything that you've ever done on the internet.
Yeah, so like if you're going to use Tails, don't have like a Google account because obviously that tracks like everything anyhow. at least it would be not advised to. Probably set up a different email server on something else or host your own somehow, which would be a little bit challenging, I guess you could say, with Tails, unless you can just make Tails itself. That would be interesting if you actually set up your own email server that only connects when you plug in. But anyhow, that's beyond my scope of abilities. But in you know, kind of connecting back to what that book was even talking about, there was some labor aspects of it, I think, originally. No, wait, maybe not in that book. Maybe I'm thinking For the Win, our favorite one.
Mm-hmm.
But anything going on in the labor world? Do you want to talk about some labor stuff going on in your country and mine?
Yeah, well, it's certainly been big news in the UK. I suppose about 10 days ago now was the TUC Congress. That's the Trades Union Congress. It's a big confederation of trade unions, had their big annual meeting. And what they agreed was to coordinate strike action. And they've all, not all of them, 10 unions have agreed to ballot for industrial action. And if the ballots are all in favor of industrial action and the government doesn't manage to stop the strike through some kind of technicality, it will mean up to 3 million public sector workers would strike on the 30th of November, which is kind of a big deal because that would be the biggest strike in the UK since 1926.
Wow, that's amazing.
So, yeah, and the issue they're striking about is pensions. Now, a lot of people have said it's great that the unions are finally joining the party, coming on board, you know, resisting the austerity which the government is instituting. But why pensions? Pensions are something abstract, something that happened in the future, something that people don't really understand that well. Why, of all things, have the unions chosen to strike around pensions? And shouldn't they be striking for social justice and democracy and a green economy and a whole bunch of other things? The truth is that they can't. I think it's probably similar in the US, but certainly UK labor law doesn't follow International Labor Organization conventions. And if you want to strike, you have to have what's called a trade dispute with your employer, which means there has to be an element of your contract which you disagree with and which you've been through a whole process of a dispute resolution to try and resolve. So you're not allowed to strike because you disagree with the government, or you're not allowed to strike because you don't like your employer. There has to be an actual dispute. And pensions was the only thing that they could find that 10 different unions had in common that they disagreed with. The fact that people are having to work longer and pay more into their pensions. Of course, it's a big deal. Yeah, and that is the thing, because we were speaking about South African unions last week, and in South Africa, you can take solidarity action, which means that if one union strikes, another union can go and strike as well to support them, even if they don't have a dispute. And also in South Africa, you can have political strikes. So if you disagree with the direction the government is taking, you can strike. And that was one of the things that helped end apartheid. And so we have the situation in the UK where industrial action is highly, highly legalistic and everything is set up to undermine it. It's not just, you know, the thing is that the unions have to ballot their members, which means they have to send ballot papers out to their addresses and people have to vote whether or not to strike. And there's a huge amount of scrutiny on those ballots, which means that the unions have to keep their membership systems completely up to date. There's a case with our union last year where they balloted more than 1,000 people on industrial action, and 11 of the ballots were found to be not acceptable because the people who had voted were people who would be leaving their jobs before the strike started. It wouldn't have changed the result of the ballot because there was a huge, something like 80% in favor of strike action, but the strike was ruled illegal because of that. So, you know, a lot of people hear all of that and they say, okay, we agree the law is wrong. Why don't the unions just break the law? Once again, not as simple, because if the unions break the law and call for an illegal strike, they become legally liable for the costs of that strike. So essentially the government could seize their assets and say, we've lost so many billion pounds because of the 3 million people who didn't work today. Let's seize all the unions' assets and bankrupt the unions. So really the only thing that can be done is individual workers can wildcat and take their own kind of action without the permission of the organizations, without the permission of the unions, because there is no legal way that unions can mount any kind of proper political resistance to what's happening.
Yeah, wow. That sounds very similar to what's going on here in the States too. I mean, the unions are restricted on what they can strike on. Mm-hmm. The solidarity strikes don't exist because of past laws that were preventing any of that from occurring since like sometime in the 1800s or something like that. It's just ridiculous. It's unfortunate. It kind of speaks to like how do we work around this stuff in the States and a lot of the developed nations outside of like a lot of European nations have restrictions on strikes, and it's frustrating because there are not many ways around it. One of the things that kind of comes up from this is like in the States we have this thing called minority unionism, which is actually, it's within the law though, which is kind of interesting. But instead of trying to actually get a full union, so like the current laws as it stands under the National Labor Relations Act is to form a union you need to get 50% plus one to vote for the union. In order for that to happen, you need to ballot to start an election process, and you need at least 30% of the workforce to call for an election. All unions, when they're trying to use this method, will go for like 70 or 80% to hope that they can get the 50% they need to actually win the election. And that's it's a very crazy process, but once you have a union, you have a union. The union can be held liable for a lot of things, just okay. like in the UK, where minority unionism works is instead of trying to start an election process to form a union, you work with your coworkers, because if you and I work for the same employer and you have a complaint and I agree with the complaint that you have, if you go into the boss's office alone, you have nothing to protect you. But if you and I go in together, with me knowing that what you're going to talk about, the collective actions and the collective rights are instituted immediately. Like mm-hmm. they okay. can't retaliate you against you for anything that happens in that meeting. Mm-hmm. If they do, it's breaking the laws. And it's not something that's very common in the States, but there are places where they use it. In North Carolina specifically, the United Electrical Workers have used this method. Now, North Carolina is a right-to-work state, which is a little bit crazy. In a right-to-work state, you can form a union. Currently, as it stands in non-right-to-work states, if you form a union, everybody in that bargaining unit is part of that union. They have to pay either the dues or a fee to cover the cost of administering the contract. In a right-to-work state, if there's a union, to pay those dues is optional. There's no requirement by law. So unions have had a very hard time forming unions in those states, North Carolina being one of them. So instead of forming a full union, they institute their rights by doing this collective action and working through minority unionism. And it's successful in a lot of ways. It's not going to be successful in going over wage increases and things like that, but it is successful in controlling the conditions, which is just as important in labor disputes and things like that. So there are ways of working around it, and those are rights that anybody in this country has, with the exception of agricultural workers, which is a whole other thing. But and some certain domestic work is not covered too. Anyway, it gets really confusing in that sense. But those actions are protected no matter what level of work you are.
Okay, that's interesting.
And it's a strategy that's not really pushed that much. And the United Electrical Workers is a lot more radical than most mainstream unions. But they see this as an opportunity to start building, because there is no union to be held liable for actions that happen. Which is the way it should be anyhow, because it's a collection of workers. So you shouldn't be able to hold some third party. And it validates a third party, which is a right-wing fight against labor unions. Like, oh, you don't want a third party between you and your boss. No, I don't. I want me and as a whole collection of workers to be confronting the boss.
Absolutely, yeah.
But so, I mean, there are interesting strategies. It's interesting that in the UK it's going over pensions, because you can strike over that. And I don't know if it's the same thing that can happen in the States, to be honest. It depends on the contracts in most cases. I'm not familiar with pension strikes.
It's probably a lot more difficult, because the difference in the UK is that we do have one labor law that covers the whole country. And it seems that you have quite different situations in the different states. So I can imagine how coordinated action becomes more complicated.
Well, sort of. I mean, there is the National Labor Relations Act, which is across the entire country. It's just in agreement to get that act passed, there were exceptions made. Which meant that states could pass something that would alter it, but not enforce it.
But see, pensions, for example, a lot of public sector workers would be employed by the individual states, right?
Okay.
Rather than by, you know, the U.S. government, whereas it's not really the case in the U.K.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah. Yeah, no, that's true. That's true. And every pension's different depending on the state that you're in, and it's not going into one big pension fund. I mean, it's not like, that's interesting, actually. Complicates things a lot. I mean,
anyway,
we can go on that bet for a while.
All this talk about strikes and industrial action has made me think of a really good trivia question, which I hope you remember for the next time you go to a pub quiz. The trivia question is, when was the first strike, the first recorded strike in history? Do you know?
Oh god, 18 something.
Good try. Actually, it's a lot further back than that, and it's pretty interesting. In the 20th dynasty under Pharaoh Ramses III in ancient Egypt.
Pharaoh?
Historians have dated it to the 14th of November, 1152 BC. Artisans of the royal necropolis at Deir al-Medina organized the first known strike. Deir al-Medina is what the village is called now. At the time, it was called Set Maat, and it's near to Luxor. And there's a big funeral complex there called the Valley of the Kings, where Tutankhamun and everyone was buried. And there was obviously a lot of highly skilled artisans working there, doing things like painting the walls and setting up the structures and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And they went on strike. And the details were all recorded in great detail in papyrus because it was the first time there'd been any kind of uprising of that nature. And if you know anything about ancient Egypt, you'll know also that Pharaoh was seen as God. So, you know, there was the whole social structure was also a religious and spiritual one. So in some senses, they were striking not just against employers, but against God and against their whole structure. So it was a real case of storming heaven. And apparently it terrified the authorities and they won.
Wow.
They got increased rations and wages and better terms and conditions from the first strike in history. So that's really cool. And that's inspired me to do something we haven't done on the show again and probably before and probably won't do very often. But if it's okay with you, I fancy reciting a poem.
I'm perfectly okay with it. Go right ahead.
Can we do poetry on the Cyber Unions podcast?
Yeah, cyber poetics.
So the poem is by Bertolt Brecht, who was a German playwright, and the poem is called Questions from a Worker Who Reads.
Hmm.
And it goes, "Who built Thebes of the seven gates? In the books you will find the name of kings. Did the kings haul up the lumps of rock? And Babylon, many times demolished, who raised it up so many times? In what houses of gold glittering Lima did the builders live? Where, the evening that the wall of China was finished, did the masons go? Great Rome is full of triumphal arches. Who erected them? Over whom did the Caesars triumph? Had Byzantium, much praised in song, only palaces for its inhabitants? Even in fabled Atlantis, the night the ocean engulfed it, the drowning still bawled for their slaves." And,
wow, that's really good. I like that a lot.
Why I like that is because it's just a reminder that everything that exists in the world was made by workers.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
From the treasures of antiquity to the computers and the equipment that we're using to record the show, all of it is made by us. It's all made by workers. And, you know, it's about time that we united to take it back. Take back control.
I think that's great. Now, that kind of brings up something that I wanted to bring up into kind of a tech section here, if we can jump into it.
Mm-hmm.
So, as you know, I've been volunteering at the Free Software Foundation a lot and discovered one of their campaigns that I was not so familiar with, and is a campaign that seems to be relatively new called Free Software Friday. And they will burn copies of Triskel GNU Linux, which is the version that the staff uses in their office is Triskel. And Triskel just came out with 5.0, their most recent version, this past Saturday, which was on Software Freedom Day. I think it's timed specifically for when Triskel comes out, or one of their cycles, because they come out twice a year. And it was really kind of cool because they would go out, they'll burn these disks, they'll give them out to people on the streets and try to push this. And it got me thinking about one of the things that I want to encourage our listeners who are in unions or who know people who are in unions, which is burn a copy of Linux, GNU Linux, and bring it to your local leaders and try to see if, at least say, look, try this because we know that you're spending money on Microsoft and my dues are not going, I don't want my dues spending money on that when there's stuff like this that is free and open and is just as able to do what we want it to do. So it's a call to our listeners to try to push your local leaders and local organizations to start adopting free and open source. But it's a pretty cool thing. So I think we should kind of remind people that, you know, we have the power to bring about change just by dropping things off at people, and especially in the movement. So
Yeah, great. That's a good story.
Yeah, it's pretty cool to see that.
Any other tech updates? Anything that we need to tell people about?
Yeah, well, there's one other piece of software I want to talk about, which is something that I'm surprised that I haven't brought it up before, considering that we actually distribute the show onto it, which is Miro. Miro, most people who are familiar with it, besides the Spanish name for, I think, C, I think is what Miro means, or vision or something like that. It's a program that one will download and play videos just like VLC and a lot of other media players out there. But the other thing that I think is really helpful for local labor unions and social movement organizations is that they have a tremendous amount of resources and information on building your own web channel and recording and producing your own work that can be put up there for your membership, for the general public or whatnot. And it's all free and open source, just like the software that we try to promote here. It's a great tool. It's something that I think can get overlooked, but the Miro and the Participatory Culture Foundation, which is the foundation behind it, have done a lot of work in this realm, and I've seen it for a number of years growing, and I just have come back into looking at it as I'm doing video production for some volunteer work that I'm working with, and it's really helpful. I think it's something that we that unions should be taking advantage of and working with. Other than that, the other thing that I wanted to bring up, and this is a call to our listeners again, I think this is maybe a call to our listeners episode, was, and maybe, I don't know if you, what you think about this, Walton, but I have been on IRCs on occasion. I've never gotten fully in depth into them, but I do realize that there are a tremendous amount of people that are on there.
Have you're talking about internet relay chats?
Yes, that is exactly it. And that's a very good point.
I've kind of logged on and not really been able to figure out what to do next. So that's about the extent of my involvement.
Well, and fair enough. And I think that's kind of where many people can get involved is good. Like, I remember the first time I went on IRC, I felt things are over my head, that I was not tech savvy enough to be in it. But I realized that there are a lot of different channels on IRCs, and there are political ones, there are non-political ones and everything else, non-technical and everything that you can imagine. And I started thinking about it since I had made some connections with some people through some IRCs of maybe creating our own Cyber Unions IRC channel on Freenode. Freenode being a very popular server for IRC channels. And I threw the question out there just on Diaspora, and it got some response. But I wanted to put a question out there to the entire community that listens to us, what your thoughts are on us creating an IRC channel. I'm going to go one step further. One thing we've never done here, Walton, is actually ask people to email us by giving our email address on the show. So if you guys are interested in this, guys and gals for that matter, my email address is mv, as in move, mnv, at cyberunions.org, which again, the link is on the show, on the website as well, but it'll be in the show notes as well. And Walton, your email address that you'd want to share?
WaltonP@gmail.com.
So what we're going to ask is to, you know, tell us what your thoughts are on it. If you want to email it, you can do it that way. If you want to send a comment on our website, you can do it that way. The other one is SoundCloud. What can we do with SoundCloud?
People can record audio and upload it to SoundCloud. And if you say something which is repeatable and helpful, we might put it on the show.
Perfect. I think that says it in it of itself of what we're asking for. So if you have some feedback and you want to do it verbally, which would be kind of cool. I've done that for one other show before, which is fun. That would be the other option of giving feedback on our idea to create an IRC channel.
Just on this IRC, I know it's what hacktivists use, online activists. I know that Lulzsec and Anonymous and people like that organize on IRC. And I think it sounds like it's where a lot of programmers and tech people do hang out. So it seems to me like it might be quite a good place to talk about unions and collective action to try and reach that kind of audience. Because, you know, I think the important thing about using technology for union organizing is that you need to use the appropriate technology for your audience. And for some people, that's a radio or a text message. But for other people, it might well be internet relay chats.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point. And I think IRC was even used in a number of the uprisings that happened in this last year, if I'm correct. And so it does play a very important role. Historically, it's actually pretty old. It's not something that's very new. It's not like Instant Messenger. Instant Messenger is after IRC coming around. But it does play an important role in connecting a lot of communities. So I don't know. I think that kind of covers the tech stuff that I had to go over today. Is there stuff that you wanted to add on the tech side?
No tech updates. And in fact, I think I'm done. I think I've had my rant about strikes and shared my updates and everything. So yeah, I think as far as I'm concerned, that's a show in the bag.
Yeah, yeah. And the one little thing that I'll put in the links at the end of the show for as well is if anybody actually is not familiar with a lot of the labor news going around in the world, there's Radio Labor and Worker Independent News that are two really good podcasts that we have both listened to mutually that is very informative about things going on globally and also in the States for when Workers Independent News. So we'll put links in the show notes too if people are looking for little 5-minute blurbs that are daily that are talking about news that's going on in the world and the labor. Other than that, I think that will be all, and we look forward to you listening to our show next week. Wow, I can't talk at the end of the show, can I?
All right, goodbye.